Hello and welcome to Inspect Tech, the Evident Non-Destructive Testing Podcast. My name is Michelle Wright and I want to thank you for tuning in today. This podcast is all about NDT and the incredible people that work in our industry. I've been in this industry nearly 10 years and I'm amazed by the incredible people and work of the community. On the show, I have the opportunity to speak with experts from the field about challenging applications, new trends, and even learn some tips and tricks for improving your NDT game. I hope you enjoy our guest perspective and inspire others in making our world a safer place. Today, we're lucky to have Dr. Peter Martin from the University of Bristol join us today. Dr. Martin is Royal Academy of Engineering Research Fellow at the School of Physics at the University of Bristol in the UK. He is an expert in nuclear energy, threat reduction, and reactor accidents, with research centered around radiation metrology and nuclear materials analysis, including current projects in the UK, USA, Japan, and Ukraine. He began his career in earth science and geology before achieving his doctorate in physics. For now, let's get into it with Dr. Peter Martin. All right. Hello and welcome. My name is Michelle Wright. I'm a marketing manager here at Evidence Scientific. I'm joined here today with Peter Martin. Really, we're so excited to have Peter here to join us, share some of his expertise and some of the interesting projects he's worked on. Peter, could you start by telling us, first, thank you for being here today. Would you mind sharing with us how you got into non-destructive testing and specifically XRF equipment?
Yeah, no, thank you very much, Michelle, for kind of allowing me to come and have a chat with you today. So, we've been really kind of excited to work kind of on XRF. So we're a kind of a material science and nuclear research group here at the University of Bristol. So we've got a lot of kind of traditional laboratory based equipment, but we also do a large amount of field work. So we visit places kind of here in the UK, but also kind of across Europe, kind of America, Australia, kind of more recently kind of over in Chernobyl. So actually having a handheld kind of bit of kit like the XRF was kind of really important, really crucial to allow us to do kind of in-field, kind of in-situ, rapid yet kind of quite accurate and quantifiable kind of analysis of materials. So it's been kind of a real kind of key tool in our kind of analysis arsenal.
That's so exciting. Can you tell me a little bit about your role at University of Bristol?
Yes, so currently I'm a Royal Academy of Engineering Research Fellow, so I'm sponsored by one of our kind of research academies. So my research is in kind of nuclear materials and radiation detection. So I do everything from kind of right through to kind of nuclear accident analysis, kind of future fuels, radiation detection for safeguards and security. So quite a kind of broad area of kind of nuclear energy kind of materials research. And part of that is involving working with guys over in Chernobyl, kind of Fukushima, kind of, and some of the big kind of US national labs.
That's so exciting. How did you, I guess to take a step back, how did you end up in this field?
So kind of, I've gotten kind of my doctorate is in physics, but I started out kind of back kind of almost a decade ago kind of in earth sciences. So my degree is in geology. So that's another field where kind of we've been working to deploy kind of XRF is kind of in kind of geological settings to actually be able to look at rocks and minerals in the field. But yeah, my background is geology. I then kind of moved into physics to look at kind of nuclear materials and accidents, kind of namely Fukushima. And from there kind of started to kind of grow and to kind of do a lot more work kind of with kind of nuclear science operators and accidents around the world. So yeah, started off kind of in the field and have kind of now returned to the field kind of to do kind of these kind of in situ analysis.
So you visited all of these sites to perform analysis of after nuclear incidents.
Yes, so we've kind of visited places like kind of Fukushima after the kind of 2011 accident and Chernobyl kind of after the 1986 accident to work out kind of what's going on, what is the environmental legacy of kind of those accidents, how is the contamination behaving, kind of how is it interacting with the environment. So we do a lot of work in that kind of area. We do a lot of work in the kind of uranium kind of metallurgy, kind of the how is it in the ground, kind of how is it geologically as well. So we go right from the front end of kind of the nuclear fuel cycle, kind of the ores, right through to the back end, and sadly, and when unfortunately, when it sometimes goes wrong.
Definitely. Can you tell me a little bit more about how, I know your most recent involvement in Chernobyl, what is the preparation to go on site to these facilities, and what's involved in order to get ready to go there, and I guess a matter of safety and regulatory issues that may go into that?
So yeah, I think a lot like any nuclear site, whether it's in the UK, the US, Asia, kind of Japan, Ukraine, anywhere, kind of there's a huge amount of kind of safety and security that needs to be met. So we need to ensure that kind of all our dosimetry is kind of very well managed, that we as workers don't kind of expose ourselves to kind of harmful radiation and kind of potentially kind of toxic environments while we're there. You've got a lot of regulatory kind of compliance that goes with visiting a lot of these sites. You can't just walk in with a bit of equipment that they don't know what it is, they don't know what it does. So there's a lot of kind of administration that goes alongside it in preparing for the visit. So everything that you take on has to be serial numbered, has to be identified, has to be kind of catalogued as to what it does. And it's for every different site, every different facility that you go into, what it does. So it's quite a large amount of preparation. It takes us generally between 1 and 2 months to visit any kind of site, whether it's Chernobyl, Fukushima, or Sellafield here in the UK. So it's a big amount of work to get on site, a lot of kind of customs if we're traveling abroad, if we're shipping it around the world. So having the kind of a really nice portable handheld XRF that we have at our disposal here kind of makes it a lot easier to kind of travel around the world, do analysis without having to complete lots of kind of burdensome kind of customs and kind of shipment compliance stuff that we would kind of with bigger, bulkier, heavier, bigger battery equipment that we found out kind of on our travels.
And that's so interesting. So for dosimetry and some of the equipment that you wear, so a dosimeter, for people who are unfamiliar, measures radiation exposure. So our devices, handheld XRF analyzers, emit radiation to measure the elemental composition of a given item. And an operator can wear a ring or maybe other materials and places like that to ensure user safety. Is there anything, do you have to wear other special clothing compared to field or lab use where there's not as, you know, the greater concern is really radiation, not from our analyzer, but from the nuclear test site?
Yeah, exactly. You raise a very good point there, Michelle. So yeah, the beam of X-rays that comes out of the XRF, yes, is quite an intense beam, but it's also very kind of collimated and is of comparatively low energy compared to some of the radiation that we exposure and that we may receive. So if we go onto any kind of site where there is the risk of kind of contamination, kind of from non-fixed or kind of moderately fixed kind of material, we have to wear, of course, the kind of the infamous kind of big bunny suits, the big kind of large overalls, kind of potentially the respirators as well, eye protection, kind of multiple changes of clothes, kind of new shoes, overshoes. So a lot of what you kind of take into the environment, it kind of has all been changed, and then any equipment that you take in is then kind of cleaned on the way out. So it's important that what you take in is very kind of IP rated, is very kind of resilient to being kind of scrubbed or cleaned and won't pick up contamination. But a lot of the sites that we visit are, of course, very experienced in handling and working with kind of equipment and kind of personnel going in and out all the time. So it's very, very kind of proficient in exiting these sites, leaving these sites, and working with the operators. But yeah, it's kind of always a consideration that people don't think of, that the XRF is itself emitting kind of radiation, but a lot of the time that's kind of quite a small kind of and very well managed amount in comparison to kind of the radiation that is within the environment that we're operating in or visiting.
So when you go to, I know you've mentioned before, you've been to the Chernobyl site several times. When you go there and you're using XRF, what are you looking for? What types of items are you testing?
Yeah, so kind of the easiest way to detect a lot of radiation from a distance is from gammas. So from the, you've got alpha, beta and gamma general types of radioactive decay. We won't kind of mention neutrons, but you can detect gamma at quite a good distance. It's very kind of characteristic of the material, but of course certain things aren't gamma emitters or have long half-lives, so they don't emit kind of at the time in which you're measuring. So then things like kind of the XRF is great for potentially the actinide materials or things with long half-lives, things that don't emit gammas, things that may emit alphas and betas that we can detect. So it's a very kind of useful part of our toolkit to be able to analyse material that kind of the what we call traditional kind of gamma spectroscopy couldn't detect. So kind of looking at the kind of composition of the ground, looking at composition of potentially anthropogenic materials that we may find, what are they made out of, and how can we kind of work out what's going on, where do they originate, and how is that kind of interacting with the environment?
I know the Vanta device you've used before, I've seen a few pictures you've shared with me where we have the Vanta, which is a handheld device, and the Vanta IX, which can be mounted on a robotic arm or something. And I've seen a few pictures where you've taken the Vanta IX and put it on a robotic dog. Do you want to share more about that and how it's helped
you?
Yeah,
no, definitely. So a lot of places, potentially where you don't know where the contamination, what the contamination levels are, kind of how dangerous the environment could be if it's unstable, if the building is kind of potentially at risk of collapse or kind of damage, then sending in a robot is kind of the optimum solution. So a robot is one lighter than a human and potentially can go into environments where you wouldn't want to send a human because you don't know what the dose levels are, how dangerous the contamination is, if it's kind of a chemically or environmentally toxic space. So as you mentioned, Michelle, we've deployed it onto a kind of Boston Dynamics spot. So everyone's probably kind of knows of those kind of infamous kind of quadruped yellow robots that Boston Dynamics kind of can make and do dances and have a little kind of hand on them that can open doors as well. So they're an incredibly powerful bit of kit that can kind of walk around an area fully autonomously, kind of repeat surveys, be able to actually use the XRF by itself. So we can use the code supplied by Olympus, the actual application interfacing from Boston Dynamics, to be able to actually do this fully autonomously. So the robot Spot in this instance can walk around, approach an object that it doesn't know what it is, do a kind of an XRF scan of it, bring the XRF right up close to it, work out its composition. We can then combine that with other sensory data to kind of do an 3D XRF compositional map of an environment. So it's kind of a really kind of deploying it with a robot is a really interesting, really powerful way of doing kind of measurements and surveys and accessing facilities that we perhaps maybe not wanting to send humans into.
It's so fascinating. Can you tell me more about the sensory data that you're collecting for that 3D map? That sounds really cool.
Yeah, so kind of a lot, as well as kind of the XRF point measurements, so we can go up to a surface and collect the XRF spectrum. Things like the Spot or other robots have lots of kind of cameras and LIDARs, so it's able to generate, kind of stitch all the images together to generate a 3D kind of photorealistic model of the site or the room or the building, as well as kind of LIDAR. You've probably seen like the kind of single point and multi point kind of LIDAR maps, the kind of meshes that we get. So we can do kind of a scenic reconstruction with either images or with a LIDAR, create this like millimeter accurate representation of the environment, add potentially other kind of data onto that, whether it's from gamma specs or from kind of laser Raman or from LIBS or from kind of any other form of hyperspectral camera or thermal sensors or the XRF. So we can generate this incredibly data-rich kind of digital twin of an environment that has all of this data embedded into it that then the user, the operator, the regulator or the safety case can actually look at and work out kind of what's going on, what are the hazards, kind of where do I need to put the attention, what's dangerous, where is the radioactivity, where is the kind of the chemicals that I maybe not wanting to kind of become too near or kind of need kind of remediating.
Peter, for the models that you create, you're then using that information to do site analysis and remediation. Will they remediate the land so it's like what is the plan?
Yeah, so with all the data that we collect, it's a lot of the time you could generate either so much data or it's very complicated to look at. So 2D data is quite hard, kind of spectral data is very hard to interpret and look at, lots of different data all meshing together is very hard and very complicated. So kind of generating a 3D map with lots of that's very user intuitive, potentially 3D that could maybe even be viewed with kind of like virtual reality, things like Oculus headsets, is very powerful. And that enables decision makers, regulators to go in and actually say, okay, that bit's quite radioactive, that needs to be decontaminated, that chemically needs to be looked at, that's the first area for kind of attention. So we can take this data, kind of present it in a really kind of user kind of focused way that enables the kind of the regulators, the authorities, those responsible with the cleanup to go in and go, ah, that area there is more contaminated. Ah, that's kind of contaminated with a material that we didn't want to be involved, kind of didn't want to be in the environment. Hence, let's decommission, let's decontaminate that faster. So the XRF has enabled us to kind of help and work with regulators, the authorities, kind of in Chernobyl and also other nuclear sites in Ukraine, kind of and in the UK, to actually target and expedite their decommissioning activities.
It's fascinating. How many tests are you doing per day with the XRF analyzers?
So it is very fast. It's got an incredibly good battery on it, so we can operate the Vanta for a very long time, potentially change the battery if we need to, or even charge it from kind of the battery packs within spots. So it takes about 45 seconds per measurement for the windows we're looking at. So about a few seconds either side of that to approach the surface you're interested in. So you could do between 45 and 60 measurements an hour of an environment, overlay that onto kind of other sensory data. So you're talking kind of potentially kind of many, many hundreds of data points or XRF full compositional spectral data points per day. So it's an incredibly data rich kind of system that we can deploy here.
That's so fascinating. So the instrument you have, does it have both alloy and soil mode to test? I know you've mentioned before testing all kinds of things there. So the ground.
Yes, so the XRF furniture analyzer we have, yeah, has the capability of doing kind of the geo, the soil, kind of alloys, metals. So it's the full suite of materials. So we can look at potentially kind of the side of reactor vessels or former kind of process pipework right through to kind of rocks in the ground, soils, kind of environmental contamination. So we can look at kind of the whole kind of gamut of potential sources of kind of contamination and kind of material composition.
I guess for when it's remote use and you're utilizing XRF on the robots, is it one of you or one of the other scientists that you travel with operating like a joystick to decide what to test in facilities where people can't go? So you're there, but you're still...
Yes, so we can view it kind of... Spot has all the camera systems on kind of its body as it's walking around. So what we can do is using the kind of these cameras, actually kind of click on an area that we want to look at, click on a surface, click on a penetration, click on a pipe, then focus on that. And then Spot will then approach it, bring the XRF analyzer up to it, fire the XRF, collect the data, and then kind of retreat when it's done. So it's fully autonomous how it kind of undertakes the analysis.
That's great. So I guess my next question is about visiting in-service plants and active nuclear plants. Are you doing in-service testing in those types of facilities that are active and working today?
Yes, so we work with a lot of kind of UK nuclear kind of sites. So already named some of them, but in order to kind of do kind of rapid kind of testing, so whether it's on a spot or whether it's on a kind of a manipulator arm or kind of even just you kind of used by hand in some instances. So the ability of the XRF to actually get results kind of non-destructively with kind of out kind of generating any dust and to get them very fast results back to the operator that can be interpreted, that are kind of quantifiable, is very important. And yet we have deployed it on a kind of number of kind of UK kind of active sites and facilities where, alongside kind of more traditional kind of gamma spec non-destructive measurements, kind of XRF has played a really important role.
That's so exciting. So in your experience, what do you think is one of the biggest challenges of going on site to these types of facilities?
I think one of the biggest challenges is kind of actually kind of the XRF is so powerful and so useful. It's actually trying to getting people to buy into it, really. I think it takes a lot of time, energy, effort, and almost kind of persuasion to persuade people that the XRF is kind of this capable, this accurate, this reliable to be honest. I think a lot of people are kind of going, would otherwise send it off to the lab, or we'd have to do some destructive assay or analysis on this material. So a lot of people, you bring it onto site and you can tell them composition steel from one steel, 316H to 316L, kind of within a fraction of a second, kind of in kind of the alloy mode. And that it takes a lot of time and a lot of kind of buying in of kind of some of the kind of stakeholders and users we have to actually appreciate just quite how powerful a kind of XRF is now. I mean, it's this system with its kind of algorithms and kind of spectral identification and kind of material analysis fitting is pretty amazing. So it's actually getting people on board and actually them believing just quite how kind of much of a step change this kind of technique kind of has become.
I guess one thing, XRF will allow you to send fewer samples to a lab. Do you have to set up labs on site with more equipment, or are you able to take samples out of the radiation zones for instances like Chernobyl?
Yes, so you've had a very good question and very good point there. So taking radioactive samples out of any environment is always a nightmare. So who owns the sample? Where's the sample going? Are you able to transport it via roads, planes, etc., etc.? So the ability to do stuff in situ without doing any, not kind of having to remove a sample and not having to kind of destructively analyze it, kind of is the dream. You don't then have to have any complications of how you're packaging it, how you're disposing of the waste. You don't have to kind of sample it. You don't have to liberate dust or anything while you're making it. So actually being able to kind of do it kind of in situ kind of is incredibly advantageous. It's very fast. You don't have to kind of set up an ICP-MS machine to do kind of your mass spectrometry on it. You don't have to do dissolution. You can just simply point the XRF up to the material and get a very accurate kind of assay within a minute without having to do any kind of pre-preparation work or kind of any work downstream to get it ready for kind of your kind of subsequent kind of compositional analysis.
That's so helpful, especially since the testing is quick. It doesn't take, not very time consuming. You don't need an operator to sit there and, you know, do lots of sample cut preparation.
Exactly. It takes you almost as long just to kind of turn the machine on than it does to get an analysis. It's so quick and so efficient, and all the data export is so fast, kind of with kind of the USB or kind of over the WLAN or kind of SD card. So you're collecting such a fast amount of data. Kind of it takes you generally longer to process the data than it does to collect it, which is always kind of a great position to be in.
One thing that's also really interesting, you know, our device is IP rated for drops and exposure to dust and moisture, but also in using the instrument, it's also given us some helpful information just about exposure to radiation by being in the in the Chernobyl environment. So it is kind of cool how that works. I think in comparison to visiting, you know, Chernobyl, so fascinating. Do you want to tell me a little bit about your work at Fukushima and how that's different in comparison?
Yeah, so kind of both of them kind of big kind of IAEA, by INES level 7, so really severe nuclear accidents. The environment and the kind of the actual accidents are just completely contrasting one from another. I mean, Chernobyl happened before a lot of this technology kind of came about. Whereas Fukushima kind of happened in kind of comparatively recently in 2011, a lot of this technology has been kind of brought in and has been implemented as the kind of recovery phase kind of has been kind of progressing. So technologies like XRF, kind of small cell gamma spec, were implemented during the actual kind of main remediation decontamination activities. So Fukushima, you're going everywhere and there's a lot of kind of XRF soil assay that's going on that we've been working on, kind of being able to kind of assay crop health as well using kind of in situ non-destructive techniques. So Fukushima is a very kind of, and Japan are very big implementers and kind of acceptors of technology. So bringing in XRF has been a lot easier into countries like kind of Japan, where they're able to kind of, they understand the technology a lot more. People like kind of Ukraine, the technology isn't as mature there. So getting into kind of Ukraine has been a bit more kind of a challenge, getting a bit more acceptance. But it's been really, yeah, good fun to work alongside the Japanese and deploying the kind of the XRF where they need it in terms of kind of the same thing, kind of remediation of land, looking at materials in the environment, kind of decommissioning of the actual main reactor site as well. So actually doing kind of the waste screening, kind of nuclear waste management, kind of container kind of assays, things like that. So the whole designing a facility to incorporate these kind of technologies right from the outset has been really interesting, kind of with Fukushima as they're kind of designing and building the facilities now, rather than the guys in Chernobyl having built them 20, 30 years ago, and now the technology is caught up with them.
I guess like one of the hot topics in the news is how AI will change the landscape. How do you foresee that will change your work?
Yeah, well, I think it's, yeah, you can't kind of look at the news one day from another without kind of seeing the huge role that AI is playing kind of at the moment. So yeah, I think in terms of the main kind of big kind of exciting areas are kind of in terms of the robotics. So can the robotic systems, you know, do it themselves? So whereas you and I would need to kind of tell a robot what to do, drive it, tell it what surface to look at, learn and go, oh, that's an area that was interesting last time, I'm going to look for that similar features, or that was an issue last time, let's try and avoid that. Will a robot be able to do it itself? Will a robot be able to kind of self-navigate, self-drive, kind of navigate these kind of quite complex kind of facilities, especially if they've been kind of damaged in an accident? So could they go in there and do the work themselves? But also then you've got the kind of the data processing, big data, AI, machine learning. As I've said, these systems generate vast amounts of data. How can we better process the data, faster process the data, more efficiently process the data to enable kind of better user interaction, faster analysis? So could AI and machine learning improve kind of the processing of it to make it kind of a lot easier for the users to interpret things like Oculus, the VR? Could that be used with kind of XRF robotic systems to generate like a metaverse almost kind of thing, to coin the term? So there's lots and lots of really exciting areas for kind of AI machine learning at the moment. It's just so vast and so exciting, it could end up pretty much anywhere.
It is really interesting. What do you think is one of the things you've enjoyed the most of your career? You've gotten to go places in the world that not many people have had the ability to venture into.
Yeah, I think kind of academia is never going to be the kind of the best kind of paid job in the world. But I think you get to meet some incredible people, you get to go to some incredible places, you get the license to do some incredible things that you'd otherwise never be able to do. So I think, yeah, going and meeting, kind of going working alongside Chernobyl, Fukushima, going visiting some of the national labs kind of stateside, going to some of the kind of amazing kind of conferences and facilities that we have around the world. It's kind of two days are never the same. And that's what's kind of really interesting, is that you get to play with some really interesting, incredible toys, people that are kind of the forefront of what they do. And I don't think I could really see myself sitting in an office kind of typing away when you've got such kind of great toys and great people, great opportunities and great kind of things that you wouldn't otherwise get to go and see and do.
That is really fascinating. What would you say is something that is your, I guess, advice for future students who are looking to follow in your footsteps?
I would say just do it. Just go for it. I mean, as a mentor of mine said, it's kind of, life is not a dress rehearsal. You only get one roll of these dice. If there's something you want to do and it's kind of, you want to do it, just do it. I mean, you regret the decisions you didn't make in life, not the ones you did. So if you want to kind of go into the nuclear industry or go into space or go into any kind of science and engineering, the world is crying out for kind of scientists, engineers, kind of technical people, kind of as we solve some of these kind of big global challenges. So if you want to kind of go and do these things, kind of do it. Kind of, yeah, get stuck in, learn, kind of understand, work towards things. And no, I my advice to you is just, yeah, get stuck in.
I love that. One thing that you told me about another project you were working on involving XRF recently was examining antiquity samples. Do you want to share a little bit about that project? Because I know that's a little bit different than some of the radiation involvement
Yeah,
radium.
so that's a very different project. So we're a big kind of, as I said, a big material science research group here at the university. So kind of we generally kind of get a lot of people coming and going, well, could you look at that? Could you look at this? What do you think about that? Is this suitable? So some guys from our kind of School of Archaeology and Anthropology came with some kind of beautiful kind of carved ostrich eggs, kind of painted by artisans, kind of through kind of the European trade routes. So they were looking at kind of, could you work out what the composition of the paints would be to look at where they came from, where the eggs came from, track the artisans, track the paints through the whole kind of thousands of year old kind of history of these materials. So yeah, no, that was kind of, again, well, we've got this XRF, it's pretty decent, should we have a go at it? And enabled us to find kind of some very kind of newly discovered pigments and kind of composition materials that we kind of weren't previously able to detect because we didn't have the kind of spatial resolution, the kind of the sensitivity, and kind of just the actual kind of resolving power that this XRF has. So from there, we were then able to kind of take it to our kind of national synchrotron and actually kind of confirm what we'd found on the XRF. So yeah, from kind of 1 week looking at kind of nuclear fallout and kind of nuclear accident disasters to next week looking at kind of 2,500 year old kind of incised and kind of painted ostrich eggs. So it's, yeah, quite a varied portfolio of work we do, but it keeps it very interesting. And yeah, another great use for XRF, to be honest. I don't think that probably Olympus have had their kind of XRF used on an ostrich egg before.
So first I've heard of ostrich eggs, but we have had some other customers testing, some museums testing on mummies, other artifacts, obsidian pieces, and similar to the ostrich eggs. Tracking the location artifacts around the world does indicate the trade routes, which is just fascinating, especially the makeup of different items and the shape and how they're able to track that. So interesting because there's just so many applications for XRF. Really, the sky's the limit, and we're always finding out about customers that have different applications that are looking to test all kinds of things from safety and security to quality to just some of the interesting human interest type things, especially like Chernobyl. That just how cool how I've been able to go all these places that most of the world has not. So
Exactly. When you're in the middle of the Chernobyl exclusion zone, kind of with some of your kind of friends and colleagues, kind of with kind of the heads of the exclusion zone and the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, kind of discussing science and kind of how you can potentially solve some of the big challenges. I think that's, yeah, what makes it kind of really interesting and kind of, yeah, this is why you do this job. This is why kind of you travel around the world to kind of it's to, yeah, to meet these people and solve these great challenges.
I think it's just so fascinating to learn and hear all about it. I know in a previous conversation, you'd mentioned how the environment in Chernobyl, in particular, like nature's returning, and can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, no, definitely. So yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, 1986 since the accident happened. I think it just completely rewilded itself. I mean, you go along there and it's been kind of completely kind of rehabilitated with kind of the wildlife, the wild deers, the boars, kind of the dogs that were left after the accident have kind of been breeding kind of quite kind of incredibly after the kind of people moved out. So yeah, it's just how everything has just been rewilded, trees growing through buildings, everything is just returning to what it was kind of pre-civilization kind of and pre-nuclear pre-accident really. It's just a very eerie place of just the stillness that's there kind of juxtaposed with kind of the accident that happened. It's kind of quite a kind of, yeah, severe nuclear accident that's made everything kind of radioactive, yet it's incredibly beautiful place how nature's kind of restoring itself back to kind of what it was. So yeah, it's an incredibly beautiful yet kind of somewhat eerie place to go and visit.
And the places that you're going there, you're not able to go. This you're going places where like people who would visit for tourism are not able to access, correct?
So it's a mixture of both. So we go to somewhere kind of the tourists are able to visit potentially for a very small amount of time, but we also go to some of the kind of the more kind of high hazard facilities that tourists aren't able to visit. So kind of the more kind of the legacy waste sites or some of the areas that haven't been characterized so kind of extensively. So hence they don't want to take kind of visitors there until they understand truly kind of what the kind of the radiological impact is of these facilities. So yeah, a bit of mixture of both sites, but yeah, right the way across the zone from some big industrial waste processing complexes, kind of that are being constructed to help kind of remediate and decommission kind of all of the Chernobyl reactors as well as four, right through to kind of some of the old kind of burial sites where material was kind of deposited in the ground kind of in the weeks and months after the accident.
So interesting. I think for my last question for you, it's been so interesting hearing all about your experiences and all the different types that you've been able to test. Is there anything that you wish you could, I guess, that you wish you could do again in your career?
I think thankfully I'm still quite young in my career, so hopefully there's a bit more of it to go. But I think I'd really like to get back out to Ukraine. I think we had some it was some brilliant collaborators over there, some of the best scientists we'd ever worked with, and incredibly interesting sites to work at, incredibly complex, incredibly challenging, very interesting. A lot of it's previously been unstudied kind of prior to us kind of going out there to work with kind of our collaborators kind of at Chernobyl and the National Academy of Sciences over there. So yeah, I think it's going to be hard to potentially get back kind of when kind of hopefully this kind of Russia-Ukraine conflict ceases hopefully soon. But I think we're really looking forward to getting back out there, going and visiting them for more science, and also yeah, really looking forward to yeah, going and seeing our colleagues, friends, out in Ukraine again. So that's the one thing I think that we're all, yeah, really looking forward to.
Thank you so much for your time today. We truly appreciate it. It's really been interesting to hear about your experiences. Thank you so much. I appreciate you joining us.